President Trump's interview with Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes has a lot of people talking this Monday morning. On Insight, the political junkie Ken Rudin adds his comments. We'll also talk about the Dianne Feinstein backlash heard at last week's rally in Iowa. An event this evening in Sacramento called Justices on Justice features retired Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy and others. McGeorge Law Professor Leslie Jacobs will preview. The event is sold out, but you can hear it online. This Wednesday, a documentary about three Nisei siblings, the Ito sisters, premieres on KVIE Channel 6. The producer, Antonia Grace Glenn, will share more of what is a fascinating piece of history. And the 23rd season for the Sacramento Choral Society and Orchestra kicks off this weekend with a stained glass concert. SCSO's founder, Dr. Don Kendrick, will join me. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's Today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. At a Trump rally in Iowa last week, those lock her up chants that were once directed at Hillary Clinton were aimed at California Senator Dianne Feinstein. Our show starts with that today and the 60 Minutes interview of the president by journalist Leslie Stahl. That segment aired last night. Plenty to talk about with the political junkie Ken Rudin. He joins us from the Washington, D.C. area. Hi, Ken.
Good morning, Beth. Just over 3 weeks to go.
That's right. Let's start with the Iowa rally. And Dianne Feinstein is up for re-election. We'll get to a, put this in quotes, debate that's coming up in a moment. But the Iowa rally was really all about the Kavanaugh process and Kavanaugh backlash, wasn't it?
You know something, there's no such thing as a gracious winner with the president because he won. They won, the pro-Kavanaugh side won. And yet the president has still not forgiven or forgotten what went on during the hearings. And he's still blaming the Democrats for poisoning the air, poisoning the dialogue in this country. So for the fact is that he has two Supreme Court nominees who are on the Supreme Court. He has more and more federal judges on the federal judiciary, which is more than any other president in recent history. And yet that's not enough. He's still talking about jailing Dianne Feinstein, and that Feinstein had stuff about Christine Blasey Ford well in advance, and she kept it from the Republicans, and it was dirty tactics. And the audience just goes on, you know, just like with the rally the president had in Mississippi last week, when basically he was talking mocking Christine Blasey Ford, and the audience, you know, was cheering every word he said. When he talked about Dianne Feinstein, they cheered as well. So, you know, he wins, but that's not enough sometimes.
Ken, I was going to save this clip for a little bit later, but since you brought up that Mississippi rally, I want to jump to a bit of the 60 Minutes interview last night. Leslie Stahl was talking to him about some of the points that you just made, and in particular, talking about the mimicking that happened with Christine Blasey Ford. So you're going to hear her voice first asking him a question.
Why did you have to make fun of her?
I didn't really make fun.
Well, they were laughing.
What I said is the person that we're talking about didn't know the year, the time, the place.
Professor Blasey Ford got before the Senate and was asked, what's the worst moment? And she said, when the two boys laughed at me, at my expense. And then I watched you mimic her and thousands of people were laughing at her.
They can do what they, I will tell you this, the way now Justice Kavanaugh was treated has become a big factor in the midterms. Have you seen what's gone on with the polls?
But did you have to?
Well, I think she was treated with great respect. I'll be honest.
But do you think
there
you
are those
treated
that think
her
she
with,
shouldn't have been?
Do you think you treated her with great respect?
I think so, yeah, I did.
But you seem to be saying that she lied.
You know what? I'm not going to get into it because we won. It doesn't matter.
Well,
we won.
So he says we won, but the grinding in continues. And Ken, I'll take your reaction on that piece of sound. And then we'll continue on and we'll talk a little more about Dianne Feinstein.
Well, you know, he said we won. And later in the interview, he said, by the way, I'm president and you're not. And he also said he didn't make fun of that disabled New York Times reporter back in 2015 or 2016. So his view of how what is making fun or not making fun is, you know, his subjective. But the fact is, as I said before, that this was, you know, he thinks that Kavanaugh is the victim, not somebody who's accusing him of sexual assault, not somebody whose actions and words he mocked before this crowd in Mississippi that cheered him on. And again, as I said, you know, he won. He absolutely did win, and maybe this should be some graciousness that's associated or attached to that, but you didn't hear it in that Iowa rally at all.
Well, he does seem to say that the fact that Justice Kavanaugh was treated the way he was in some way validates what he said at that speech. But that's aside. That may be my own opinion on this. He did say that had he not made that speech, we wouldn't have won, implying that the speech swayed the vote that happened by the senators.
Well, that's kind of silly, of course. Because, I mean, that is what he said. And that's kind of silly because, I mean, it seems like both Democrats and Republicans made up their minds well in advance. And even when you think of Susan Collins' dramatic speech on the Senate floor, I think it was Thursday, maybe Friday, before the vote, basically it sounded like her mind was already made up when she decided to vote yes on Kavanaugh. So aside from maybe a few people like Joe Manchin and Lisa Murkowski, it seemed like almost everybody's minds were made up. You didn't need a Trump rally to determine how the majority Republican Senate was going to vote on Kavanaugh.
He made reference to, do you see what's happening in the polls? So we didn't get to this last weekend, but let's talk a bit about midterm elections and how what happened over the last 2 weeks has shifted going into November.
Well, this is interesting because while the conventional wisdom is still saying that Democrats are going to pick up the necessary 23 seats in the House to put Nancy Pelosi or some other Democrat back as Speaker, the Republicans seem to be doing fine and maybe even gaining a little bit in the Senate. Heidi Heitkamp, the North Dakota Democrat who voted no on Kavanaugh, is still trailing some Republicans who were thought to be in big trouble, for example, in Tennessee, where there's an open seat, in Arizona, where there's an open seat. It seems like Republicans are gaining in those races. Ted Cruz was always thought to be in trouble against Beto O'Rourke in Texas, but now Ted Cruz has opened up a lead anywhere between 6-8 or more points. So for all the advantages, even Dean Heller seems to be holding on, despite the fact that it's a Hillary Clinton state in Nevada. Despite all the predictions that the Democrats win the House, and they still might, it seems just as likely that the Republicans not only keep control of the Senate, but pick up seats. And Trump may be right in the fact that Kavanaugh may have energized Republicans. I don't know if this is a Republican spin, because Democrats say that Democrats are really angry and determined to go to the polls. But I've seen some indications on separate campaigns, where Republicans are getting a bounce, too, in the aftermath of Kavanaugh.
What do you think of the idea, the theory that South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham gets moved somehow into perhaps the attorney general's spot? And then Nikki Haley, after resigning last week, decides to run for his Senate seat in South Carolina.
Right, or get appointed to it. Well, that's been the theory. The theory, of course, is Jeff Sessions is gone as Attorney General after November 6th. I think that's more than a theory. I think that's pretty likely. It was also interesting to hear the president talk about Jim Mattis, the defense secretary, on the 60 Minutes show, talking about, well, he's a Democrat. And if there's a curse word in the president's vocabulary, it's Democrat. So Mattis may not be long for this political world either. But look, the speculation about Nikki Haley, I don't know. I'm not sure Lindsey Graham keeps saying he doesn't want to leave the Senate. He doesn't want to be attorney general. But it's fascinating to watch what's happened to Lindsey Graham, because once upon a time, he was a strong critic of the president, or at least the candidate Donald Trump. During 2016, he mocked him for the two of them despised each other. And now, maybe even more so now that John McCain, his ally, is gone. But Lindsey Graham has been the one of the biggest acolytes that the president has. And it's kind of shocking to see the transformation of him. So if he does become attorney general, of course, he would resign his South Carolina Senate seat. And then the Republican governor there would theoretically appoint Nikki Haley. I don't know what the future of Nikki Haley is. I just know that she seemed to have left at a good time for her, because her numbers are really huge. And I don't know what her future is, running for president or making money or whatever it is. But But right now, she's one of those Republicans that even Democrats see themselves possibly voting for.
Leslie Stahl last night on 60 Minutes said to the president, Jeff Sessions, can I assume he's gone? And the president said no. But later on General Mattis, the president did say, here's the quote, I think he's sort of a Democrat, if you want to know the truth.
I mean, isn't that something? Once upon a time, Jim Mattis was one of the golden boy in the cabinet. He was, he stood up to the president. But I think, one, because the president doesn't like anybody standing up to him. And two, the fact that National Security Advisor John Bolton and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has gotten so close to the president that maybe he doesn't feel that Mattis is loyal enough. Maybe Mattis doesn't agree with the ending of the Iran nuclear deal or the warming up to Kim Jong-un. When Trump said he fell in love with Kim in North Korea, I mean, that's remarkable. Like, I have a feeling that Jim Mattis is expressing his disapproval and unhappiness. And of course, he's quoted in that Bob Woodward book as saying that Trump has the intelligence of a fifth or sixth grader. So maybe that once romance between Trump and Mattis is over. And if that's the case, Mattis could join Sessions among the unemployed come November 6th.
Love was discussed in that interview last night. I think we'll post a link because maybe we've intrigued someone who hasn't heard it yet. And we'll put the link out there so you can hear that whole conversation. I'm talking with Ken Rudin, the political junkie. So let's loop back around to Dianne Feinstein. And this week on Wednesday, there is going to be Some are calling it a debate. It's probably more like an hour-long conversation that is happening actually at the Public Policy Institute of California, which is a polling organization in California. But this will be between U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein and California Senator Kevin DeLeon, her challenger. She is not a debater. She has not debated a challenger for, I think the date, Ken, goes back to October of 2000.
That is correct. She has not debated since 2000, and I don't know if it's because she's 85 years old and she's the oldest member of the Senate. And maybe she's off her game, although she sounded pretty good. She sounded very good, actually, during the Kavanaugh hearings. But the fact is, Kevin DeLeon has been asking and demanding a debate. They're both Democrats, but that's the California system. They were the top two finishers in the June primary, so that's they move on right to November. And Feinstein not only is not, it's not going to be on TV or radio, it's you could only get this on the web, and you have to register for it to watch it on the web. So I know that incumbents with huge leads often don't like to debate their challengers. Gavin Newsom only allowed one debate with John Cox, his rival in the governor's race, and Dianne Feinstein is following the same thing. But the fact is that, she's been in the Senate since 92. She has a record to defend, and I would think that she would have a good defense of it. But the fact that she seems to be doing everything she can to avoid being on the same stage as DeLeon, avoiding that as TV or radio, that it's going to be web only, is a typical incumbent tactic, somebody who has a lead. But the point is, and something we should point out, is that her lead over DeLeon used to be 20 some odd points. Now it's down to 11,
right,
with 3 weeks to go. I don't know if it's enough for him to keep pushing forward, but I would kind of think of that if voters feel that she's out of touch or losing ground, some votes could shift between now and 22 days from now.
All right, Ken, we're going to leave it right there because we're talking about what the president last night described as the world of politics, the most deceptive, vicious in the world, a world full of lies. And then he said, at the same time, nobody's been able to do what I've been able to do. So there you have it. One more final thought from the president.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Nobody has been able to do what he's done. And that's for better or worse. That's for sure.
All right, Ken, we'll talk to you next Monday.
Thanks, Beth.
That is Ken Rudin, the political junkie. We'll post a link to his website at capradio.org/inside. We'll also post a link to last night's 60 Minutes interview from CBS. This is Insight on Cap Radio. listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. McGeorge Law School is hosting an event tonight to mark the creation of a new endowed chair named after retired U.S. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, and the retired justice himself will be there. Justice Kennedy joined the McGeorge faculty back in 1965. You probably know that he announced his retirement from the Supreme Court last summer, and that is what set into motion the proceedings that ended with the confirmation of Justice Brett Kavanaugh this month. McGeorge Law Professor Leslie Gilo-Jacobs is in the studio with me. She is also director of the Capital Center for Law and Policy and was a law clerk to U.S. Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell. It's always a pleasure to have you here, Professor Jacobs. Thanks for coming in.
I'm so happy to be here.
I want to spend time, first of all, on the Kavanaugh situation, because Chief Justice Roberts has now requested that the Tenth Circuit investigate some ethics questions about Justice Kavanaugh. This is a packet of allegations that's been moving along, and now with the Chief Justice moving it to the Tenth Circuit, what does this mean? What's in process?
Well, to be a little more precise, he referred it to the Tenth Circuit. I don't think he directed that it be investigated. And so by referring it to the Tenth Circuit, he's giving the Tenth Circuit the decision-making about what exactly to do with these complaints. And the Tenth Circuit would have to review the complaints, decide whether there were grounds that should be investigated, and then they have a number of options for looking into them if they decide they should be looked into.
I understand that most, if not all of them, relate to the September 27th hearing, and that they initially went to Judge Karen LaCraft Henderson, who had dismissed some of them, but she found others valid, which is why they moved on, correct?
Yes. Certainly what Chief Justice Roberts wants is to have another circuit be the one to look at and make a decision about what to do.
Do you know what the legal basis of the complaints is?
I think that they're based upon a claim that, in fact, there may be ethics violations. I should point out, however, that the Supreme Court is not subject to ethics rules. The courts of appeals are, and so there's a little bit of a question here about exactly where the nominee was at the point when he was doing this. And I think that will be a question for the Tenth Circuit, whether, in fact, there are ethics rules that cover this. I assume as well that there are claims about the need to disqualify into the future on the Supreme Court. And those rules do apply to the Supreme Court. Impartiality is supposed to be something that the justices have. And they are the ones, though, who make the decision about whether there's an appearance of bias that would happen if they were to sit on a case.
Meanwhile, there were hundreds of law students who walked out of class in New York last week after Justice Kavanaugh heard his first case. And the quote that came from the leader of that group is, "We do not recognize Kavanaugh as a legitimate member of the U.S. Supreme Court." And so he's beginning this term, a new term. He's beginning his term as a justice. What do you take from the tenor of the court right now, and is it possible for it to be business as usual?
Well, I think they are conducting business as usual, and certainly the Chief Justice is going to do everything he can to make it be business as usual. People have the right to express themselves in all sorts of ways. It's the United States of America, and there's free speech and the ability to engage in conduct that sends messages, and certainly the students are allowed to do that. But the court's going to continue with business as usual, and it's a long year of arguments that will just keep plodding along, and I think that's probably what's going on there.
You're teaching this semester, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
So to what degree is this conversation, or will it be, in the classroom? And what will you say to your students about the impact on the process?
Well, we think about it all the time when we look at the cases and we talk about the justices and we talk about their different opinions. Certainly, we talk about decisions that the court makes and their self-consciousness about their legitimacy. The abortion decision that Justice Kennedy, along with two other justices, authored, had a lot of conversation about what it takes for a court to be legitimate and how important it is for the Supreme Court to be legitimate, because it doesn't have an army. It can't enforce its decisions. And so we talk about it all the time, and we'll continue to talk about it.
What kind of latitude does a justice have? And some of this question can go back to Justice Clarence Thomas, when you step in to the high court and you have controversy and drama surrounding you, can you sort of pull back? Can you take it more low-key for a while?
Justices can make their own decisions about how they're going to behave on the bench, and they do behave in different ways on the bench. So, yes, justices have lots of latitude. They're appointed for life. They really aren't overseen in any particular way. There are questions about Congress's ability even to impose ethic rules on them. So they have a lot of freedom to decide how they're going to behave and how they're going to attempt to appear legitimate.
Do you have a prediction about how Justice Kavanaugh will take his role, especially in this first term?
I don't have a prediction. I think we're just going to have to see how things go.
You and I have talked before at the beginnings of a term about the cases that the Supreme Court decides to hear. With Justice Kavanaugh on the bench and the number of conservatives in the court, do you think there are different cases that we will see coming before the court than before? And if so, in what arena?
Well, it takes four justices to vote to hear a case. And so changes we would expect might be in areas where the new justice would differ, for example, from Justice Kennedy. So we'll see. We may see gun rights cases going up. We may see cases having to do with affirmative action and perhaps abortion. Those would be cases where we might see this new justice being different, actually not gun rights, different from Kennedy, but it does take four votes to take it. So those would be the areas where I think we might see some more cases showing up. Agency action, scope of the ability of agencies to make environmental rules and health and safety rules.
So Justice Kennedy is on this panel tonight, and the event is sold out, but there will be monitoring online. People are free to submit a question online, and you are moderating the panel. Is this some of the direction that you expect the conversation tonight to go?
Tonight we're having a comparative constitutional conversation, and it's such a nice thing to be doing with Justice Kennedy here. We're celebrating the Sakopoulos family gift of $1 million to McGeorge, which is a huge thing for the law school. We're so pleased to have it. And the Powell Fund matching that with $1 million, which gives us a $2 million chair. So we're celebrating that and to bring Justice Kennedy back onto campus and to be having an international panel is exciting because Justice Kennedy embraced international law, at least in some areas, as providing information for him in interpreting what our own constitutional rights mean. And so here we have these justices coming and we have a former California Supreme Court justice as well, all of them talking from their different perspectives, but coming together to have a civil conversation, a respectful conversation about both samenesses and differences.
So let's say a bit more about who else will be here this evening, Presiding Judge Ann Power Ford. Tell me about her role, because you said this is an international panel.
Exactly right. She was served for a number of years as the judge, the elected judge for Ireland on the European Court of Human Rights. The European Court of Human Rights is interesting because it's 47 countries at this point who have gotten together, and they've signed a treaty, the European Convention on Human Rights. And so what the court does is interprets those rights and then applies them against the countries. And so it's kind of like our constitutional rights with the federal court applying it against the states, but it's different because it's countries.
Also, former Justice Joseph Grodin.
Exactly right.
Yes.
And so he's going to be there, and there we're going to get a different perspective about constitutions. He's specialized in state constitutional law, which we may think, oh, constitutional law is all the same, but it's actually not at all. So we're going to be very interested to hear what he has to say.
And with more international perspective, Judge Wolfgang Brandstetter.
Exactly right. And he comes from Austria. And so he's on the Austrian constitutional court. And so what's different about European countries, many of them, is that they have a specialized constitutional court. And so all it does is interpret the Constitution, as opposed to, for example, our Supreme Court, which interprets all sorts of things, including regular old disputes that happen to involve people from different states, or also statutory interpretation. So constitutional law is one job of our Supreme Court, but the specialized job in Europe and in Austria.
There's been a long relationship between McGeorge and the University of Vienna, correct?
Actually, Salzburg.
Oh, Salzburg.
That's where
okay.
our summer program is. And so certainly Justice Kennedy has taught there year after year for our summer students, moving from teaching our evening students on campus to teaching the day students during the summer in Salzburg.
You are listening to McGeorge Law Professor Leslie Gilo Jacobs. The event tonight will be live streamed on YouTube. It is from 5:30 to 7. And am I correct about questions being submitted in the process of this live stream?
Yes, yes. I'm not completely familiar with how that's going to happen, but you sign on to our live stream and there'll be a way to do it.
Okay. Tell me more of the topics that you'll be covering tonight. Constitutional law and interpretation is very broad. What specifics are going to come up?
Exactly right. Well, we'll talk about different individual rights. For example, race, sex, sexual orientation discrimination. Obviously, the California Supreme Court's dealt with that. Our U.S. Supreme Court has dealt with that, and the European courts have dealt with that. So we'll look at the ways it's the same, but also the way it's different. One way that it's different, affirmative action is more accepted in Europe. The rights guarantees are interpreted differently. So I expect samenesses, differences to come up. Free speech, hate speech is something that is okay to regulate in Europe and not okay to regulate under our Constitution. And that can actually pose some issues because we've got an internet that just shoots across the globe. So we've got different rules and difficulty in making them harmonized. And then also, what, religious liberty? That's going to be in some ways similar. We have rights of religious freedom. But one thing that's different is that we in the United States have what's called an establishment clause, which means the government can't help religion that much by aligning with symbols like crosses or by giving money to private religious schools in certain ways. In Europe, it's just much more accepted. They don't have that kind of clause. And so here we have different democracies having different ways of looking at things and interpreting rights. And so we'll be talking a lot about that.
Can I just go back for a moment to the whole picture of the process leading up to the installation of a new Supreme Court justice? Do you share the opinion that was expressed by many people that the whole process was so marred and so tainted, or that part of the process is broken now, that there was a permanent damage, that something happened that's going to affect the court nomination and confirmation process for all time now? And I guess I'm looking for your gauge on whether it was and has been and will continue to be as powerful as was expressed during that very intense, volatile 2 weeks.
Well, what happened recently is part of the longer history of the confirmation process. And it's difficult to look at how far one should go back to look at that. But interestingly, the confirmation process that led to Justice Kennedy becoming a justice began with Judge Robert Bork being nominated and being not confirmed because of ideology. Then there was another judge who was also nominated who wasn't confirmed. And then Justice Kennedy was nominated and confirmed. And the rest, 30 years, I think almost it was, is history. And so you can date it back whenever you want to, but that ever since then, there have been lots of conversations as people have been confirmed. Certainly this confirmation has to be looked at not just by itself, but as part of the confirmation that happened a year ago of Justice Gorsuch. What had happened then is that, in fact, the Senate had to change its rules in order to be able to confirm Justice Gorsuch by a majority vote. It used to be that for Supreme Court justices, you could have what's called a filibuster, and it would actually take 60 votes to be confirmed. So that went on, and then now we have this going on. So it's part of a process where, indeed, things are becoming much more contentious. And I think people look at the Senate and look at a body that used to be more collegial across party lines, and it's just not. And we could say that's too bad, I think, for democracy.
Well, thank you so much for, in what is a very busy day, spending some time with us. I'll again let everyone know that Justices on Justice is going to be a live stream tonight from 5:30 to 7. The event is happening at Pacific McGeorge Law School, but it is sold out. We'll post a link. It will be a YouTube link that will be live tonight. And you should be able to add in a question if you choose to. So thanks again, Professor Jacobs. Always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me.
That is Professor Leslie Gilo-Jacobs from McGeorge School of Law. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. The story of three Nisei sisters born on a farm in the Sacramento Delta traces Japanese-American history and will be told in a documentary premiering on KVIE Channel 6 this Wednesday. Airtime is 7 p.m. The project is titled The Ito Sisters, An American Story. And in the studio with me is the producer, Antonia Grace Glenn. Hi, Antonia. Glad to have you here.
Hi, Beth. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me about these sisters. And they are all in their, what, 80s and 90s right now?
Actually, all three of the sisters have passed away. But the three sisters are my grandmother, Lillian, and her two sisters, Nancy and Hetty. And the project really grew out of a series of home movies that we filmed with the three sisters, where we interviewed them when they were in their 80s and 90s. And we originally just wanted to capture some of the familiar family tales. But when we got them together, they really started talking and sharing stories that they had not told us before, and sometimes that they had not even told each other. So the film really chronicles their memories of their parents. They tell the stories of their parents' immigration from Japan. Their father came over in 1897 at the age of 16 by himself and arrived in San Francisco and became a houseboy, a domestic worker. Worked his way up to owning a jewelry store in Chinatown and then lost everything in the San Francisco earthquake of 1906. Mm-hmm. And they tell the story of how he took what jewels he could and put them in a trunk and pushed it up the hills and down the hills of San Francisco until the fires caught up with him. And then he kind of had to take what he could on his person and run. And so he lost everything. And at that point, he moved to the country, to the town of Cortland in the Sacramento Delta, and became a farm worker and a sharecropper. And then he subsequently went back to Japan to find a wife, married my great-grandmother, and then they came over, and the three sisters recount how their parents spent 3 weeks on the ship in what was called Asiatic steerage, mm-hmm. And my great-grandmother was 6 months pregnant at the time. So the first of the three sisters, Nancy, was conceived in Japan but born in the United States. So they share everything from their parents' immigration experience to life on the farm to attending segregated schools to having arranged marriages and then through their experience in the wartime concentration camps. So it's really chronicling sort of the first half of the 20th century through the memories of these three Japanese-American sisters. And it's set against the backdrop of the anti-Japanese movement at the time, which was a very powerful anti-immigrant movement from the 1880s through World War II and beyond. And that provides kind of the cultural and political and historical backdrop for my family story.
The era that they lived in alone would be so rich and colorful and heartbreaking at times. But you have home movies and old photographs and clippings, and we get voices, we get music. We do have a clip from the trailer, so let's listen to a little bit, and then we'll talk more about the way you tell the story.
Wonderful.
I mean, generally speaking, Japanese women immigrants didn't have the leisure to be housewives, that's for sure. And so provided a great deal of agricultural labor or, the small business sector, and were, I think, crucial to the success of their particular families.
What was the name of the school?
Portland Oriental School.
Oriental. In grammar school, Japanese, Chinese, and Mexicans, and all those, mm-hmm. and then the Caucasian were separated.
Yeah, at that time, I think all the girls my age were arranged by the go-betweens mostly. Everything was already arranged, I think. That's why I thought that I had to marry a guy anyway. So that's how it went those days.
They're so contemporary in their language, but it's fun how the three of them help each other fill in the gaps in their stories.
They do. They're very engaging and memorable characters, these three sisters. And they do. They finish each other's stories. They still evidence sibling rivalry after all of these years. Some of the anecdotes that they were referring to include the fact that, they attended this segregated school in Cortland. There were four towns in Sacramento County that established segregated schools for children of Chinese, Japanese, Indian, and Mongolian parentage. Mm. And so they went to what was called the Cortland Oriental School. But there was only one school bus in the town because it was a small town. So all of the children rode the same school bus, but it would stop in front of the white school. And the white children would go into the white school, and the Asian children would have to walk the rest of the way to their school. So, you know, they share stories like that, which are, you know, so particular to that time period. And that, you know, I think are very valuable to kind of know those sort of little details of what life was like in that community at that time.
You've used illustrations. There are some wonderful pictures, comic book style, and some are a bit animated, to help carry us along and know some of the history, which you'd think in this area a lot of the history would be known. But there are gems in here. There are pieces of stories that are not known, that aren't in a museum exhibit somewhere.
Absolutely, yeah. The idea of creating the illustrations came from my wonderful co-producer and editor, Greg Pacificar, because we realized that sort of watching the three sisters talk in their interviews that we needed a visual element for a film. And so he brought in this fantastic artist, Manny Falcon Padua, who created all of these illustrations for the film. They were inspired by my family photographs. We created a color scheme that was inspired by Japanese woodblock prints. And so for the memory pieces of the film, we use original illustrations. And we also brought on this fantastic composer, Dave Iwataki, who created the score. So we have the music that's all original to the storytelling as well.
You're listening to Antonia Glenn, the producer of the documentary The Ito Sisters, An American Story. It premieres on KVIE Channel 6 in Sacramento this Wednesday at 7 o'clock. It's a part of the Viewfinder documentary series, but it's been expanded to an hour. And it's already an award-winning film at the Berkeley Film Festival, both Audience Award and Documentary Award winner.
Yes, and we also received the Emerging Filmmaker Award at the Sacramento Japanese Film Festival. And we're going to be at the Boston Asian American Film Festival later this month. So that'll be our East Coast premiere. So we've had a series of really wonderful screening events around the state so far.
What have you heard from audiences, and what did you want people to take from the story?
We're hearing remarkable stories from people. We're hearing from camp survivors. We're hearing from people whose families were incarcerated in the camps, but they didn't necessarily know their family's stories. It was very common in Japanese American families not to talk about the camp experience because it was considered shameful. And there's a Japanese American concept called gaman, where you buck up and you sort of endure. And so I think a lot of the older members of the older generation didn't want to dwell on their camp experiences. And so I've heard from people. A woman came up to me and said, you know, my mother never told me about, doesn't want to talk about camp, never told me anything. So I came to see your film to learn about my mother. Mm. And a college student came up to me and said, my grandmother hasn't talked about her camp experience and she has Alzheimer's. Mm. So those stories now are gone. And so the fact that you have those stories in your film, you know, she started to cry, saying that it was, you know, so meaningful for her to hear those stories. And so that has been incredibly powerful and meaningful to us to have those community conversations. And additionally, I would like people to reflect on the contemporary parallels to the anti-Japanese movement from 100 years ago, that we're seeing the same rhetoric, that we're seeing the same wave of scapegoating of Latino immigrants, undocumented and Muslim immigrants, and that we're seeing family separations and we're seeing the incarceration of children in camps today. We have the current administration talking about establishing camps at locations close to where the Japanese American camps were. And so we're seeing that history really repeating itself. And the Japanese American community has been very vocal in saying, not again. And that when you start down this road of scapegoating and dehumanizing immigrant populations, that it can lead to massive civil rights violations. And we are seeing it happening again. So I'm hoping that my film can be part of the conversation around really reflecting on these anti-immigrant movements.
So the sisters knew, because you were interviewing them, that this project was going to happen. I assume that all three passed before they were able to see some version of the film. But just knowing that they were participating and that this would be a story that would be made into a concrete piece of the literary landscape out there, what was their reaction?
Well, they did see some early footage. And of course, they all had such different personalities. So Nancy, who was the oldest, she was always considered the most beautiful. And they tell a lot of stories about how they, how she had a lot of suitors who wanted to marry her, although she ended up having an arranged marriage that was not so successful. So she, when she saw the footage, she was very pleased with it. And then my grandmother, Lillian, who was the middle of the three sisters, when she saw the footage, she thought it was embarrassing. And Hetty, who was the youngest, who described herself as being short, dark, and ugly as compared to her tall and pretty sisters, I think she would have been very pleased to have her stories memorialized. And for example, there was one story that she told that she had never even told her sisters, mm-hmm. which was when the three of them were sitting talking about Nancy's suitors. I think Hetty got a little jealous in that moment. And so she revealed that she had had a secret engagement during the war when the family was all in the camps. She was allowed to leave the camps to go to beauty school. And she had been corresponding with Japanese American soldiers as a patriotic effort. And she had met a soldier and they'd been corresponding and he'd come to meet her and he'd given her an engagement ring. And when she revealed this to her parents had intended to arrange a marriage for her with go-betweens. And so the go-betweens told a lie that Hetty's fiance was seeing somebody else. And so Hetty's parents told her, break off the engagement and return the engagement mm-hmm. ring. So she put it in a matchbox and sent it off to him. Mm-hmm. And she told the story to us for the first time as part of these interviews. And you see the sisters sort of saying, well, that's too bad. And then Hetty says, well, he died early, so it's okay. And they have this moment where they all laugh because, they think it's very funny. So it's a painful memory. But the way in which these sisters often share things is in this kind of cheerful manner. Yeah. And they laugh. But you sometimes have to read between the lines to kind of see the some of the pain and the trauma that they endured throughout their lives.
There is a lot in this film. Thank you for bringing the documentary to us. Good luck with it. And I think there are a lot of ways into the story that's been told. A beautiful film.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here, Beth. Thank you.
Thank you. That is Antonia Grace Glenn, the producer of the documentary The Ito Sisters, An American Story, Wednesday night at 7 on KVIE. There's a link, and you can see the trailer at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Sacramento Choral Society and Orchestra begins its 23rd season with a concert October 20th at the Fremont Presbyterian Church. The group just released its 10th CD. It's an album recorded live at a concert this past May. In full disclosure, I do need to say that one of SCSO's recent board members is Cap Radio's COO and CFO, June Reyna. That said, we have featured many concerts and recordings by SCSO over the years. And in the studio with me is its founder, Dr. Don Kendrick. He is director of choral activities and music director. He's also a Sac State professor emeritus. Welcome.
Thank you, Beth.
Busy as ever.
As ever. I'm semi-retired, but I'm still keeping my oar in the water.
Let's start with the CD release, 10th annual 10th. CD.
Hard to believe it. We have 10. Last May, I did my last concert with my Sac State choirs and the Choral Society and the orchestra and the children's choir as soloists. The stage was packed with my best friends, 350 people on the stage at the Community Center Theater and about 1,700, 1,800 people in the audience. And I did a concert that was called of Jubilate, and it was a farewell to all my choir kids at Sac State, and I'm missing them terribly. But at any rate, we actually got $12,000 worth of funding to produce that CD,
wow.
which is what it costs to produce these CDs, and we've done was it 10 of them, I think?
Yeah.
10 of them at $12,000 each. So it's a lot of money. But some very good friends within the choir came forward and wrote a check. And we produced that CD into edited down. It's a live performance in the Community Center Theater, but it's a great CD and it has all those pieces on it.
I think we have a clip so that we can hear some of these voices together. Let's listen to a bit from the CD.
Okay.
So we're jumping ahead a little. That wasn't quite from the CD, but go ahead.
We're going to come to some of the music from the CD a little bit later, I think. But that opening... So anyway, I'm very excited about having that CD available at this concert for sale. But the opening piece... You know, this concert I'm doing, the opening of the 23rd season of the Choral Society in Fremont Presbyterian Church this Saturday night at 8 o'clock, is going to feature three pieces I have never done in my life. And when you consider... how old I am, I've conducted...
Or how much music you've
and how
done.
Much music I've yeah. conducted over all of these years. There's pretty well not much that I haven't conducted in my life, but this concert, this Saturday, is basically three pieces that I've never conducted before. Mm. Arvo Pärt, who's an Estonian composer and really regarded as one of the most important components of his school. We visited Estonia this past summer on tour. We were in Estonia and Latvia and Finland. And so I'm opening the concert with a piece of his called the Berliner Mass, which is the Berlin Mass. And Arvo Pärt's music is very stark and very cerebral, and there's not much counterpoint. And it's difficult as can be because literally every bar is a different meter. I mean, they're counting 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 9, and it's nerve-wracking to sing his music. But it's very, very pure and straightforward. And that was just a clip you heard from the Gloria, the opening of the.
Last week's Sound Advice, we just talked about Arvo Pärt because Anne Akiko Myers just recorded some of his music on violin, she described tearing through it and trying to follow all his markings. And then when she played it for him, he said, "Why did you do that?" And it made her realize that he composed it by his mind and his approach, but that he was leaving latitude, understanding that others might have their own interpretation.
Right. Well, I'm finding that in this beautiful mass that he wrote for the Berliner Mass. And it's, as I said, every bar is a different meter. So we're constantly counting. I mean, for 30 minutes, we are literally counting like mad to get through the piece. But it's very pure and it's very, very minimalistic. And it's just a wonderful piece to listen to. Unlike anything we've ever heard in this town, and it's never been done in this town. And then we're moving into 1772, way back to Mozart, and we're going to do a piece by Mozart that I have never done before also.
I think we do have a clip of that. Let's listen. Voices will you have on stage?
About 130 singers for this. So it's not the full choir. It's about two-thirds of them. And there'll be only because of room. We can barely get 130 people into Fremont Presbyterian Church. It's going to feature organist Ryan Enright. And he's probably the most brilliant organist here in Northern California. Mm. Dr. Enright is our accompanist. And he's also the organist at St. John's Lutheran. And it's featuring the organ in this work called The Litanies, and Mozart was very unhappy when he was living in Salzburg, and he wrote four different litanies, and this was written between his second and third visit to Italy. But it's a great prayer of supplication and veneration for the Eucharist, and it's going to feature some of the finest soloists we're bringing in from the San Francisco Opera.
And then the third piece that you're doing.
And then we're going to move to a piece that, again, my third on conducted piece ever in this town. It's called Laudis Organi, and it's by Zoltán Kodály, who's a famous Hungarian composer. And it was the last work he wrote for Atlanta, Georgia, for the National American Guild of Organists convention. And it really features the organ as the king of instruments plus the choir. And it sounds a little bit like this.
So you can hear that live at the Stained Glass Songs in the Spirit. It's this Saturday, 8 o'clock, and Dr. Don Kendrick continuing to direct the music and the choir. Congratulations.
Thank you.
On one of the busiest retired people I know. We'll have more online and more about the Jubilate CD at capradio.org/insight. That's Insight for today. Thanks for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.